Today, hyperinflation. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of its posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. It's Friday, and I have Tarek Brooker with me again. Hi, Tarek, how are you going?
Not too bad, Martin, yourself?
Pretty good. How's the world of journalism treating you?
Yeah, pretty good. I mean, there seems to be quite a lot of demand for my particular skill set at the moment, so I'm not complaining.
Well, that's good. Demand is good. The trouble is, it means you've got to supply something too, I suppose. So always on the lookout for good stories.
Definitely, mate, definitely.
Well, I think a really good place to start this discussion would be with this inflation, deflation, hyperinflation issue, right? Because it seems to me that of all the issues that are buzzing around, there are more diverse opinions on this than almost anything else. You know, Yellen came out the other day and said, well, we're probably going to have to bring interest rates up sooner because of all the stimulus that the US is doing. We've got Jerome Powell saying there's no such thing as inflation. It might blip up a bit, but it's not structural at all. We've got the Reserve Bank in Australia saying there's nothing to see here. We've got the Bank of England also saying, no, inflation is not really a thing. I'm not sure whether they are really spinning a yarn or whether they actually believe it.
Well, that's the big question. I mean, inflation versus deflation is literally the biggest question that we face at the moment in the world of economics and finance, because, you know, one or the other, you know, could potentially be, you know, devastating for asset prices. It could be, you know, enormously important to the global economy. But, you know, and we're sort of stuck in a situation now where we need this Goldilocks scenario, whereby we need this ideal situation where inflation can't be hot, too hot, but we can't have a deflationary environment either, because that could potentially just cause, you know, the entire thing to unwind. But you raise an interesting point regarding the central bankers, because there is a lot of dissenting voices developing, you know, both in the Bank of England and in the Fed, in terms of what they're going to do in terms of asset purchases, you know, quantitative easing, and interest rates more broadly. Because, you know, I mean, I was reading the one dissenting vote in the recent QE vote for the Bank of England. The dissenting voter wanted them to end the purchases much, much sooner, with a much, much smaller amount of purchases being done. And, you know, whereas, you know, sort of this time last year or even the end of last year, there weren't these dissenting voices. It was just everyone was in lockstep. We need to win this. But now, you know, as things sort of look up a bit, that we're seeing these divisions emerge.
Yeah, well, it's Andy Haldane, of course, from the Bank of England. Their economist, who's just leaving now, said that it was time to turn the tap off. Of course, Canada is slowing their rate of asset purchases, so that's the second indicator of people actually getting a little bit twitchy. And interestingly, a couple of the Reserve Bank leaders in the US, not Jerome, who sort of sits over the top, as it were, but, you know, down the pack, are also signalling concerns about this. And it's very interesting. If you read the notes from some of the investment banks, they are literally, you know, to an analyst, saying there is significant worry about inflation. In fact, we think that there's very significant indicators. And interestingly, there was also some data that showed that in the US, at least, the cost of, for example, furniture is going up, the cost of other manufacturing products are going up. And in fact, some of the big manufacturers have announced price increases. So in particular sectors, there is definitely stuff going on. But if you look here in Australia, the ABS data relating to the relative cost of living indices by segment went up only a little bit over the last quarter. And there's really very little official signs of inflation. So it seems to me there are two questions. The first is, what do you mean by inflation in the first place? Are you looking at some prices? Are you looking at wages growth? And secondly, how are you measuring it? And I think that probably the how you're measuring question is probably the most critical one, because if you're not measuring it right, or if critical asset classes like land, for example, are missing anyway, it's not going to give you the right answer to start with.
Well, no. I mean, we've been operating under what's a way of being nice and sort of diplomatic, an incorrect set of assumptions, shall we say, for quite some time now. And, you know, that's unfortunate, because it's meant that monetary policy hasn't been set in such a way that, that it suits the entirety of our society rather than just this, you know, perverse relationship between asset prices and monetary policy. But, you know, as you were saying about the inflationary issue, you know, I mean, even the Bank of America had a note out the other day, and they said that they said that we are calling transitory hyperinflation. Now, what exactly that means, I don't entirely know, to be completely honest with you. But it certainly sounds like a hell of a headline, doesn't it?
Transitory means it's short term. Hyperinflation means it's bad, right? I guess. But I mean, they've got a point about it. You know, the transitory discussion is quite interesting, right? Because if you think about what they did and how things fell off a cliff a year ago, you start from a very low base. So if you start from a very low base and then you start getting it back to where it was, then you would expect the numbers to be quite significant. I mean, give you an example, the cost of childcare, right, was taken out of the CPI number because effectively the government was paying for it and now it's back in. So that put the costs up, right? But that's not a real number. That's just that's a mathematical blip because of the way that it's calculated, right? And there's a lot of those around. It's trying to see through those and trying to understand whether there are actually levels of underlying price growth, assuming that you define inflation in price terms. And of course, one of the big conundrums here is that if you think about the relative price of a new TV and its utility relative to 10 years ago, it's way, 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 way cheaper than it was. Whereas if you think of the cost of carrots, for example, well, they're significantly more expensive than they were. So it does come down to a question of what's in the basket, how you calculate the basket. And we know from a range of analysis that if you apply the old-fashioned approach of calculating inflation, you'd end up with a much higher number than the way that the ABS does it here and the way that the statistical units around the world are doing it. So it's fudged, I would say.
Well, that's a big call, isn't it? In the world of defamation lawsuits and everybody getting all argy-bargy.
Well, you know, I'm just saying, you know, there are different ways of calculating it. It does come back to how you calculate it anyway, right? I think, personally, you won't really see real inflation unless wages growth really starts to take off, right? And if you go back to the 1980s when interest rates were very high, we had massively high inflation, right? And that was often driven directly by wage growth. Now, okay, you can argue that Nixon took the US dollar off the gold standard, and that was one reason why rates went very high. But it's also a fact of matter that it was actually strong wages growth that drove a lot of the other things, and they had to try and control it. So the 2-3% target from central bank land is trying to keep wages growth in a reasonable area, right? So whether in fact measuring prices and trying to impute inflation from prices is actually sensible is an interesting question. If you measure wages growth, nothing to be seen. And in fact, even the Reserve Bank is saying, well, wages growth is unlikely to be happening any time in 2023, 2024, maybe, if you're lucky. But interestingly, Guy Debelle yesterday, in a quite long lecture that he gave, put this on the table. Which would you prefer, higher house prices, or would you prefer lower unemployment? Because lower unemployment will ultimately lead to wages growth. In other words, you can have wages growth, or you can have higher house prices, you can't have both. That, for me, was a complete nut of an argument, right? Because I don't think those things are mutually exclusive, but that's what he was arguing.
Well, it doesn't really make much sense, does it? I mean, we had affordable housing for a long, long time, and we had higher wages growth than we have now. So clearly that's a bit of a historical furphy, looking at it from that perspective. But, I mean, even just looking at it more broadly, is there really any evidence that lowering rates by, say, 0.25% has any material impact on the labor market aside from the additional wealth effect that it provides through higher housing prices?
No, I don't think there is. And in fact, I'd argue that lower interest rates are one of the factors which has skewed the relative wealth generation from consumers across to corporates. So if you look at corporate profits, they've gone through the roof. If you look at wages growth, for most people, it's gone sideways or nowhere for a generation pretty much now. And that's more to do with partly the economic cycle, but also partly to do with where rates are. The other thing about those asset prices, obviously, Jerome Powell mentioned an F word the other day, right? Not the F word, but a F word, which was frothy, right? He said, actually, you know, there's evidence that prices are frothy at the moment, and that's because of obviously all the quantitative easing and stimulation and what have you, right? Well, then he went and said, like, nothing to see here, it's not a serious issue. But I thought that was very interesting that he's actually conceding that asset prices are, you know, rather high. But let's be clear, rising asset prices and rising home prices is not the same as wages increases, right? It's like comparing apples with pears. Now, what Guy Debelle was saying was, well, if you lift interest rates, that would have an impact of calming housing prices, but it would also put more pressure on people and wages growth would be a problem. But of course, there are many other controls that could be put in place to deal with the housing market, macro prudential controls like they've done in New Zealand. You don't need to just, you know, pull the old interest rate lever quickly. I think there's an argument for saying keep interest rates really low for as long as you can to try and get business to borrow. But you've got to tighten up lending for housing, because otherwise housing will just continue to run away from us, and we'll see those massive new flow data trends, which was huge this last month, right? So we saw a return to property investment. In fact, property investment last month grew faster than owner-occupied lending in percentage terms. Now, okay, percentage terms is only one way of measuring, but it's quite useful. And the other is that first-time buyers are now coming off their peaks because they're starting now to compete with property investors again. So there's a bunch of reasons why you'd want to follow New Zealand's macroprudential ideas, which would be to tame investment and reduce the tax breaks for property investors, make it a little bit more of an uphill gradient from a lending perspective to lend to other borrowers, increase the loan-to-income and debt-to-income parameters and the loan-to-value ratios to create more of a buffer. And for my mind, as they've done in New Zealand, the Reserve Bank should be given a specific accountability for home price trajectory. Because at the moment, and Debelle said this yesterday, he's not interested in home prices. It doesn't worry him. It's not something which is in his ambit of responsibility. Neither is it APRA's responsibility, right? Which then begs me the question for me is, well, who is actually accountable for the trajectory of home prices, other than, of course, ScoMo before the last election, who said, well, of course, home prices will be higher under our watch. is it a purely political thing, or is it actually time for somebody to stand up and take more responsibility for this?
Well, it is time for somebody to stand up, but whether or not that's actually going to happen or not is a completely different matter. I mean, we had the Housing Minister, Michael Sukar, the other day talking about, you know, basically who was at fault for the housing affordability issues that we face in Australia. And he laid the blame at the foot of the states and for the lack of, you know, releasing new land for property development, you know, for, you know, urban sprawl and additional, you know, high-rise developments, et cetera. And it's really quite interesting listening to Sukar make that argument, because it's the federal government who ultimately decides the, you know, how financial regulation works in Australia. And it's also the federal government who decides the immigration policy. So it's, you know, it's basically on them how many people come into Australia and then where they end up. Yet by the same token, it's on the states to produce all the infrastructure needed to support all these additional people. So, you know, it's sort of just, you know, passing off the responsibility to someone else. But I mean, that's not really all that surprising. You know, we've seen that quite a lot recently, you know, at all levels of government, unfortunately.
Well, this is interesting, because what it basically says is that nobody wants to take responsibility for high house prices. Everybody, I think, now accepts that house prices are way too high, right? So if you look at it on any of the sensible measures, even if you look at just the repayment discussion, right, it's still pretty high. But on every other measure, debt to GDP and debt to income levels, it's way too high. And now, of course, the government's backing away. It's saying it's not them, it's the states. The Reserve Bank and APRA are saying it's not us. So nobody is actually stepping up and taking responsibility. Now, the point, of course, is that this is a complex matrix of different drivers, supply and demand factors. But trying to actually argue that there's a lack of supply when there's 1.2 million spare properties available in Australia is a bit of a long bow. Bearing in mind, we're still seeing way more construction going on at the moment. A lot of subdivisions, a lot of new townhouses and apartments being placed on what would have been one house and land unit previously. All of that suggests that we've got an oversupply into a market where there isn't enough people to actually take them up. Now, interestingly, of course, Sukha went on to say that he was considering potentially trying to do something for, quote, the high-rise sector, to recognise that they were in difficult at the moment. So I wouldn't be surprised to see in the budget something which basically allows the government to hand even more money to the high-rise developers to allow them to go on building. Now, why would you want to do that when you've got too many properties there already, 1.2 million plus? It doesn't make any sense at all. And the problem I've got, as we've said several times before, but I'll say it again because it's so critical, we are putting too much of the economic, momentum in the economy into construction and housing and mortgage lending compared with the real economy, which is sort of being starved of investment. And I don't think we're necessarily going to see significantly large investments in the budget beyond that. And that's a problem, because basically what it says is that we're stuck in this rut, and this rut's getting deeper and deeper, and house prices will go on going up. You know, the Reserve Bank's not going to do anything about it. Rates will stay lower for longer. And that just creates a polarization of the haves and the have and the nots with regard to property. And then we touched on the Bank of Mum and Dad. You did an article on it the other day as well. The Bank of Mum and Dad's a critical indicator of the problem, right? You've got some people who have rich parents who can buy property. You have other people who have no rich parents who can't buy property. This is something which is really getting to the critical point, and yet nobody wants to take that holistic joined-up thinking. They want to do little patchwork fixes and, you know, fix it in line with the political cycle rather than the strategic stuff which needs to be done. That's the problem that I see.
I think one of the issues at the moment, like you mentioned, say like with the budget, is that we have this narrative that everything's great, you know, the property market's booming, the economy's going to the moon, etc., etc. And it's like, okay, well, let's just say, for argument's sake, that all that is true, that the economy has recovered completely, that everything's going in the right direction, and everything's perfect and is going to be perfect for the next couple of years, which it isn't. But let's just say that it is. And okay, if that's true, why are we running enormous deficits as far as the eye can see? Like, that's what I don't understand. You know, like we have these two completely mutually exclusive narratives of economic exceptionalism on one hand, but enormous support required into the economy for years and years and years to come on the other. And just on the topic of the high-rise sector, I wouldn't be surprised if we end up seeing some form of government payment to convert unused office towers into residential properties, because simply put, you know, if the work from home is here to stay and some of these occupancy rates are here to stay, a lot of these super funds are going to get absolutely smashed on these REIT investments that they have in these office blocks and even some of these retail spaces.
Yeah, well, you know, I've said before, bank keeper was the name of the game. Now it's going to be super fund keeper as well, right? I mean, the problem is that everything is being looked at through the financial system lens rather than the broader economic lens. And so they're worried about financial stability, and they're trying to prop up the banks, and they're trying to prop up the super funds, and they're trying to make sure that the assets in the bank balance sheets don't go down, and that the banks have very cheap funding. Now, the term funding facility is going to go on till June. That they've then got 3 years to pay off their 0.1% borrowing. So it's like, you know, that's not going to go away quickly. And I agree with you. There's certainly a risk at the moment that super funds are going to find that their commercial investment portfolios are being shot to pieces because no one's living and working in them. So trying to move them into residential might well make some sense. Although, of course, we have too much oversupply, particularly in those same central business district areas. If you look at Melbourne 3000 and Sydney 2000, there are some of the highest vacancy rates there in the high-rise sector, some of the lowest rental returns of anywhere, and yet we're building more stuff. So this doesn't compute, I'm afraid. Can't square it up.
Well, it doesn't need to compute. I mean, it computes in the eyes of the government, and it suits their interests. You know, I mean, if they need to introduce apartment keeper in order to support, the apartment sector and property prices in those areas, then, you know, that may be what they do. And I mean, just going back to the title of this video, I mean, I really do wonder, do the RBA have the courage, really, to raise rates to move, you know, with the rest of the pack, you know, to sort of, you know, address the issues that we may have with inflation if they do occur in Australia? Can they bring forward, you know, their promised rate hikes several years and then actually address the problem? Or are they just going to sit back and do nothing and watch the Australian dollar blow up in their face?
Well, let's just think this through, right? So let's assume that the Fed puts rates up before we do, right? Now, that's going to make investment returns potentially in the US more attractive than here, right? So what does that do? That has an impact on the exchange rate, and that could potentially actually lower the exchange rate here. Now, that would seem to me to be something the Reserve Bank would be quite keen to do, because they would say, I think the exchange rate's too high relative to where it should be. So they probably will want to hold rates lower for longer to get the exchange rate advantage.
They do. But the question is, what if it sort of becomes, you know, a major, major issue rather than just being, you know, a gap of, say, a quarter of a percent or, you know, a third of a percent. You know, there is the New York Fed president, sorry, former New York Fed president, came out the other day and was talking about the prospect of US inflation going to 4 or 5% and the need for the Fed to tighten rapidly if they do get behind the curve. Now, I could see the Fed being forced to do that, potentially. I mean, and there's certainly the appetite there from certain Fed members, say people like Kaplan, but would the RBA have the same courage to move rapidly and to tighten rapidly in that way if presented with a similar issue here in Australia? Because, I mean, you know, 4 or 5% inflation is a fairly significant, you know, issue. I mean, I don't know if it's whether it's going to happen or not, but if it does, you know, in a sustained way.
Well, I think it's fair to say, I don't know what you think, that the Reserve Bank here has been off the pace for at least a decade, right? They've tended to be slow. They've tended to respond probably too slowly to the emerging situation. They've tended to undershoot their targets and not achieve them. I don't see any change of appetite or momentum that would suggest that's going to change. So I think they'll probably be slow to come to the party. I think they'll probably only mess around the edge and probably will, as a result of that, not necessarily take us to where we need to get to. I mean, they haven't taken us in the right direction for a long time, in my view, despite the fact that many people are very supportive of what the Reserve Bank has done. They've done it through the wrong lens. They've done it through the lens of the property sector and the finance sector rather than actually the broader economy. And I come back to, what is the mandate of the RBA, right? What are they there for in the first place? There is actually a charter that you can see on the wall if you go into Martin Place, right, which is a reminder of what they're there for. And it's about the economic success of the country and you know, and everybody, right? Well, if that is really what they're at, I would say they've been should be marked a fail.
Well, that's the thing at the RBA. You're allowed to fail. Failure is rewarded. You know, you don't achieve your wage growth forecasts, that's fine. You know, you don't achieve your basic mandates, that's fine too. You get a promotion. You get a bonus. It doesn't really matter. And I mean, in a lot of ways, look, I understand that the RBA are hamstrung by the tools that they have. You know, they've got a hammer, and when you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So, you know, they just keep hammering away at lowering interest rates. But realistically, you know, that to me isn't an excuse that justifies the way they've conducted themselves over the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, they should be working with the Council of Financial Regulators, which is APRA, which is Treasury, which is the RBA, and they should be looking at things and going, how can we improve things? You know, we have this research from the Bank of International Settlements, from our own researchers, that shows that high household debts are severely curtailing activity within our economy. We have data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics that says that real household disposable income has gone nowhere for years and years. We have all these things indicating that we have problems. We should sit down and we should address them. It's all well and good to say, oh, it's the government's fault. But let's face it, that has it saying, oh, hey, Turnbull, Abbott, Gillard, Rudd, ScoMo, you should do something, hasn't worked in, you know, however many years they've been doing it since the GFC, 12 years now. And it's not going to work now either. So I think that they really need to get together and they need to go, okay, well, what can we do to address these problems? What can we do to minimize the systemic risks and maximize the potential, the growth potential of the economy? Now, I know that there are going to be certain people who lose, because in any decision by government or a regulator, there's always someone who loses. But if the loss is just the, you know, the further capital gains in property prices, and prices just stagnate because they put some form of, you know, debt to income ratio, like in the UK, into the system for mortgage lending, then I think that would be beneficial, because at least then we can start to, you know, deleverage, pay down the debt, improve our economy, rather than, you know, ending up the way we are, where, you know, one in every $6 that flows into the economy flows into servicing debt.
That's a scary number, isn't it? And remember, that's not equally spread across the population, right? So we know that a lot of people have no debt, you know, roughly a third or maybe even more. So it's actually quite concentrated. You know, there's basically the rule of thirds. A third of people rent, a third of people have their property without a mortgage, but a third have the mortgage. So in fact, the real repayments that people are making is extremely high. That's one of the problems with the averaging reporting that they actually come up with. I'm not even sure whether the Reserve Bank would understand the question, though, right? Because there's a couple of basic assumptions they have. Basically, the first assumption is credit's not the problem, right? So, and that's because they define assets and liabilities as two sides of a single equation. And so you can go like that, but it cancels each other out. So it doesn't matter. Right? It doesn't matter if debt rises because you've got the asset growth, right? And in fact, De Bail, in his speech yesterday, highlighted wealth creation off the back of higher home prices. So that he thinks that's good, because that wealth creation is then more likely to lead to more spending, which means it's more activity, which is what they want. So that's their thinking, right? And that's a very neoliberal approach in terms of thinking about it, right? So debt's not important. The fact is, of course, we know that they can create as much credit as they want. We're already seeing this with the ability to be able to actually issue bonds and then buy bonds. And that's a pretty much limitless pool, right? And some would say, I think I'm probably in that camp, to say that they're following half of the MMT story in terms of saying, well, you can increase the level of debt. That's not a problem. But the other half of MMT is about what you do with the money, right? And the money is not going into the places it should be to create the long-term sustainable growth that we need for our economy. And so therefore, they're not really following MMT in terms of execution and delivery. It's just merely using it as a funding mechanism. So that's a real problem. And then the other issue is your point, which I want to underscore, they're not accountable, right? I mean, they get dragged in front of you know, the various economic committees and what have you, but they hardly ask any hard questions. And, you know, to my mind, they are really given a very easy ride. And I'd almost argue that, you know, there's sort of this agreed, halo around the Reserve Bank that nobody can touch, right? They sort of are the untouchables. And yet they're the ones that have led us into a blind alley. And I still maintain I've heard nothing from them about how to get out of the blind alley, right? So we've got this really, really low set of interest rates. We've got the quantitative easing going through the roof. We've got house prices going through the roof. We've got unemployment not where it needs to be. And we've got wages growth nowhere. Now, if they are saying the solution is to keep interest rates really low for a long time and let house prices grow even faster over a period of time, which will create wealth, which will mean that people will spend more, which will create growth, which means it will translate into lower unemployment and therefore wages growth. Boy, that's a very long set of ifs, right? I don't find it very convincing.
Well, their own forecasts don't find it convincing, though, do they? You look at the RBA wage growth forecast going forward and, you know, it's neither here nor there. You know, they're talking about, you know, housing prices going to the moon over the next couple of years. You know, something like, you know, 30% growth. Some of the banks now are talking about even more than that. And what, they're talking about wage growth getting to at most 2.5% by like 2024. I mean, that doesn't really sound like it's working to me. You know, what about you?
No, does not compute. As I said, does not compute. Yeah. And very importantly, of course, there is a bunch of people who are trying to get into the market, right? And to get in the market, they've either got to save for 10 years now, compared with 6 years a few years ago, or they have to raid the mum and dad savings to get into the market. But they're committing more and more of their savings into getting into this impossibly expensive housing market to try and get on the back of the train, because the train is running away from the station at ever faster rate. And if you miss out, then you're probably never going to get on. That's the sort of the mentality, right? But, you know, there is a point at which you say, well, hang on, at what point are house prices silly? I mean, are they silly now? Or are they silly in a few, if you double it, you know, if you triple it? I mean, you know, there seems to be no logical, you know, limiting factor, because you can throw more debt at this and you can create unlimited debt and you can basically keep interest rates really low and you can drive it. So basically that's the model. That model is bust. It's not going to work. It's not worked for at least a decade. Look at Japan. And I want to make the other point, which is that if you actually don't think that's going to work, then the future is not inflationary or hyperinflationary. It is actually deflationary. And that actually then creates another set of feedback loops that go in the negative direction. And, you know, Japan's been at it longest. They've got very little signs of inflation there. And those countries around the world, like the Eurozone, who've been at quantitative easing, have not been able to create inflation either. So I just wonder whether we've got bankers and central bankers talking their book because they can't countenance the idea of their model failing, and yet we're looking right at their model failing.
Well, the model's failing regardless, isn't it? I mean, whether we end up with an inflationary future or a deflationary future, it's either going to be too much inflation or too much deflation in all likelihood. You know, the chances of them, you know, creating this Goldilocks situation where we end up being able to achieve, you know, that perfect situation is, well, it's going to be challenging to say the least. I'm not going to say it's unlikely, but, you know, it's going to be a toughie. And just on the topic of housing prices, I think part of the problem at the moment as well is that we're seeing sort of like this, what I'd consider like this two-stage rocket type thing. You know, you've got the start, which is the first home buyers. They all get in the market. That starts the, you know, the rocket taking off. And then that breaks away as housing prices get too expensive, as people get priced out, the deposits get too large, bank of mum and dad gets tapped out, and then the investors are all going to jump in. And then it's going to send it to dizzying new heights because, you know, buy now or miss out on these beautiful free capital gains.
Well, and of course, the states benefit from new construction fees. And, you know, there's a bunch of reasons, as well as the banks, who actually all believe that it's a great Ponzi scheme, right? I call it a Ponzi scheme. They wouldn't call it that, but they would say that it's a hugely economically advantageous thing. I would say it's a Ponzi scheme. You need more people coming in the bottom to feed the Ponzi scheme, right? You need people to climb up the ladder, right? And unfortunately, the rungs are getting farther and farther apart, right? I mean, it is, if you stand back and just think about it objectively, it's a crazy, crazy world that we've created. And yet there are very few people who are really wanting to say, hang on a moment, there has to be a better way. Everybody is sucked into the same game. And that's true of both sides of politics. You know, nobody wants to actually have the hard conversation about, well, we've come down this cul-de-sac, how do we get out? But that's the real question to my mind, because as soon as you start putting rates up, you're going to start putting significant pressure on households, and that will dampen economic activity. So you're right, trying to find the Goldilocks zone. I think the other problem is that there's an arrogance amongst central bankers who think that they can just manipulate the levers slightly and, you know, the whole economy will just turn exactly right and it will actually then head off in the right direction. But I actually think what they're doing is they've got these levers, right? And those levers are actually not connected to anything solid. They've actually got rather a lot of elastic and a lot of give, and they pull something and it goes the other way, right? Because the wind's blowing really fast. Right? And what it means is that they're trying to steer a course which is actually never going to be, you know, where they want it. So their arrogance to think they can is because they actually don't get how dynamic and how weird the real world is. So they try and simplify it. So the Martin model, is a simplified model. It's got a lot of stuff taken out of it, you know. Credit's not there, as we've discussed earlier. So there's a bunch of things they take out to try and make it manipulable. But the point there is, if their model is actually broken and the things they're trying to manipulate aren't working as they expected, what's the first thing you do? You pull the levers a bit harder and say, well, it won't work, I must pull the levers harder, right? What you don't necessarily stand back and think is, hang on a moment, maybe my model ain't working as I expected and maybe we should consider alternatives. That is the conversation that they should be having, but as far as I can see, that's not the conversation that anybody's having.
Well, that would require them to take responsibility for the last 12 years not turning out the way they planned, you know, rather than just laying the blame at the feet of somebody else. I mean, like, I read these analyses sometimes by, you know, American, you know, Wall Street analysts or academics, and they talk up, you know, oh, the Fed has achieved this, the Fed has achieved that. What a load of bull, please. You know, it's like, oh, they've achieved this with employment, they've achieved that. It's like, so low rates took what? How many years was it to get unemployment down in the US? 11 years?
Yep.
You know, 11 years to get unemployment down. Now they're saying, oh, look, it's happening now. Look how much faster it's happening, you know, this time. It's because we're doing all this QE and all this other crap. And it's like, no, what's happening is fiscal policy. And this brings us back to the deflation, inflation debate. Like, you know, we've been discussing this now for what, probably a year. You know, maybe a little bit longer. And, you know, both of us are in the deflation camp and we have been for some time. Admittedly, that is our, you know, I mean, I won't speak for you, but for me, that's my long-term view. And obviously, we've got to sort out things like supply chain issues and stimulus needs to feed through the economy first. However, the thing that gets me is people go, well, you know, you deflation people are wrong. You know, look at what's happened, you know, since, say, the start of the year. But what they fail to mention is when they made all their inflationary calls, it was like September last year. And since then, the US, the Biden administration and the tail end of the Trump administration has put in $2.8 trillion into the US economy. And there's still probably another, what, 2 to 5 to 7 to whatever crazy crap they want to come up with to come. And it's like, well, of course it is. You've just injected something that's nearly six times the size of Obama's entire GFC response plan, which was spread over 2 years. And you guys have done it over 4 months. And you're saying, oh, look at all our inflation. Look at all this. I just feel like saying to them, it's like, you guys have achieved 1.56% quarter-on-quarter GDP growth after injecting $2.8 trillion. $2.8 trillion. Now, that is literally enough to scrap the entire US Navy, rebuild it from scratch, and have money left over. That's how much money that is. It's just insane.
Yep, absolutely right. And, you know, it goes right back to the fundamental point is, what would have the alternative been if they'd spent that money differently?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, there was an analysis done by one of the American banks a few weeks ago, and they concluded that in per capita GDP and inflation-adjusted terms, the stimulus so far had been 30% larger than Obama's response to the GFC and all of the years of the New Deal combined. Larger than that. And, you know, like, don't get me wrong, the GFC stimulus wasn't exactly impressive because a lot of it went to bailing out Wall Street. So, you know, that's neither here nor there. But, I mean, think about what they did in America during the New Deal. You know, the dams, the roadways, the water infrastructure, the rail infrastructure, you know, the subsidies towards industry that made it possible for the US to win World War II, all these different things. And we're all just sitting here, but like, well, what have we achieved? It's like, well, look at the price of Dogecoin, you know? Look at that. I mean, you know, we've achieved that. That's much better than all that other stuff. I mean, who wants a productive economy anyway?
Well, who wants a productive economy anyway? I do, because it's critical. It's critical for our future, right? But that's not what we've got.
No, it's not. And like, I just don't understand it. Like, it's just incalculably stupid to me. Like, I look at them in the US, they're like, oh, we need to give out more stimulus checks. It's like, who thought it was a good idea to give stimulus checks to people who are on two and a half times median household income? What was that ever going to achieve? You know, these people saved it, they plowed it into the stock market, you know, they may be going to spend it on a holiday to Cancun or, well, maybe Australia, maybe we'll get lucky and we'll at least see some benefit from it. But that's it, you know, and not only that, but now in America, because of the labor shortages, all these distortionary policies have created in places like Montana and North Carolina, they're turning off the support entirely as of June 30, because it's got to a point now where if you've got a McDonald's and you want staff, you can't get anyone to work because you get paid more money sitting on your ass at home getting paid by Biden. So I don't know. It's just going to be this enormous mess because you're going to have certain states saying, well, crap, we've got to turn this off. Otherwise, we're going to have, you know, labor shortages. We're going to have serious economic problems as a result. But then by the same token, America is not like Australia or Canada or the UK. If you get cut off from your unemployment benefits, that's it. When they turn these unemployment benefits off for millions of Americans, that's going to be it. There's going to be no more support. That's it, Dunskies. And it's just like, well, we're really sorry. You know, you don't have any food to eat and you can't pay your mortgage, but you get nothing. And that's the problem in all of this, that Biden or Trump or just the US political establishment in general has taken absolutely zero opportunity to make substantive changes and instead has done all this absolute bull on, you know, tinkering around the edges with temporary programs that have done nothing but distort things and just create this situation where millions of people are going to be left in the lurch when it's all turned off. And for these people in North Carolina and Montana and elsewhere who are going to get, you know, nothing as of June 30, I just feel horrible for them. It's a joke.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the end state, so I've got this view, right, which is to say there are some alternative futures. One alternative future is where you ultimately end up with, you know, the universal basic income. So basically this handout process goes on to the point where everybody just gets something every month, right? And that means that those people can then pay, you know, some bills and pay their mortgages, which means that effectively they've got cash flow, which means they can go back into the financial system to complete the financial system and allow it to continue to maintain the repayments on their loans, which, by the way, they'll extend, so you'll get the 30, the 40, 50, 80 year mortgage. So it all becomes cash flow, right? But that's not productive. That's not a productive economy, right? And yet, that's one future. The second future is, as you say, when they turn it off and essentially the support mechanisms get withdrawn. And that means that you have a larger and larger proportion of the population that becomes more and more off the pace when it comes to the ability to be able to live and eat and, you know, pay their bills and those sorts of things. And so you create this massive break between the haves and the have-nots, which we know has been growing significantly, and the data from the US shows that. So that's the second one. The third one is that neither of those work. And so you end up essentially with the 80-year cycle, right, which peaked in the 1980s when rates were very high and inflation was very high. Rates have been coming down every time there's been a crisis. Basically, rates get dropped, move up slightly, then drop again. And, you know, they've come to the point now where rates are actually at zero, right? So you've gone through this cycle. So then the question is, well, what's next, right? Do you then completely replace that with something else? I don't know, central bank digital currency or cryptocurrency or something, right? Or, you know, the old great reset story comes in some way, right? I mean, those are the sorts of things that, because I don't see how we can just maintain the momentum that we've got and just tweak the tiller slightly and assume it will get right, because it won't. So we've got those crises ahead of us, I think.
The thing is, like, I mean, as you say, you know, we do have crises ahead of us, but it's also the fact that we were heading for a lot of these crises long before COVID came around. But the difference now is that we have much, much less ammo in order to cope with them. I mean, you know, the US has blown through, you know, over $5 trillion. You know, Europe is up to its eyeballs in debt. And, you know, you got to a point now where the ECB is buying something like almost two-thirds of all new issuance of bonds. And you don't really have much of a market anymore. It's just this strange zombified thing that just continues to exist because no one really knows what we do without it. And I think that's what is really concerning going forward, because the current status quo is so fragile and it's so easy to see how it could be undermined in any number of ways. And I think that's what makes, you know, things like, say, for example, like the tensions between the US and China so concerning, because it's easy to see how that could blow up into something horrible. And, you know, I mean, even if it just ends up being something along the lines of, say, China, you know, takes Taiwan somehow, you know, in the next, say, three or four years, has the ability to take it, and the Americans just get, you know, shoved out of Asia with their tail between their legs. I don't think that's what will happen, but let's just imagine for a moment it is. You know, I mean, there are some fairly major scenarios that I've read from some experts that are basically talking about that being the end of US dollar dominance in the entire world. Now, you're talking about the end of the complete end of an era, the end of a system of a dollar-based system of as and the US as the guardian of global trade all of a sudden coming to an end overnight. You know, that's sort of, I mean, it's not quite a Roman Empire collapse situation, but it's not, you know, several orders of magnitude away from it either.
No, I agree. Well, you know, that's definitely a scenario that many people are arguing. And of course, then the question is, well, what's replacing it? Is it gold? Is it a gold-based currency system? You know, and some of the Asian countries have been accumulating significant amounts of gold. Is it a digital system backed by gold or something else? You know, I don't know. But it begs some very interesting questions about future state, right, and what the future state looks like. The trouble is that, you know, nobody really wants to think about it because they're basically still dealing with tactical trimming of the sails rather than actually the strategic stuff that we've been touching on. I guess for Australia, you know, frankly, we're saved by, what, $200 a ton for steel?
the old iron ore thing. I mean, where would we be without it? We'd be a third world country without it, I would imagine, relatively speaking. Well, relative to where we are, anyway.
It's a major contribution, right? So basically, yeah, the price has gone up again. You know, hit the new all time high, and China is, you know, the predominant purchaser of those steel assets. So look, that's the thing that's kept the country going is effectively steel, right? So that's pretty much it. So you know, as I remind people, Australia has a very narrow-based economy, houses and holes, right? So houses and holes, what, houses and steel, right? It's crazy. It's crazy. Why can't we have a more sensible, rational strategy on a broader footing being developed? And why can't we have people in leadership positions who actually want to do more than just sort of turn the handle on the existing system and make a few tweaks here and there? And by the way, not have much accountability for anything that happens. Not good.
Well, it's like the old lucky country, you know, adage. You know, what a lot of people don't realize about that is it's actually an insult to Australia's politician, you know, because it is, you know, a lucky country run by second-rate people who share their nation's luck. And that's unfortunately been all too accurate, you know, for some of our leaders in recent decades. But, I mean, I suppose the thing is that for the longest time, the government just sort of got away with tinkering around the edges, you know, 80s, 90s, you know, 2000s. We, you know, there were some obviously substantial things in terms of, you know, Medicare or, you know, things like that on a social level, but on an economic level, we haven't really sort of pressed on ahead with things that would transform our economy for the better, to diversify it, to make it more resilient for tomorrow. And really, I just can't help but look at the last, you know, 12 or 18 months as just an enormous wasted opportunity. I mean, we've spent over $300 billion on stimulus. I mean, I think that the thing is that it's easy to say things like, oh, $300 billion, but it's such an incalculably large amount of money. You know, I mean, I'll give you an example. If we spent the entire thing on fighter jets, we'd have the second largest air force in the freaking world. You know, like, we could just go around screwing stuff up. You know, it's just nuts. You know, it's just a silly, silly amount of money. And I just can't help but, you know, think about what we have to show for it. Like, you know, I know some tradies who, you know, did quite well out of JobKeeper. They got themselves a jet ski or a caravan or a new ute out of it. But for the rest of us who are just, you know, working away and paying our taxes, I'm not seeing much of a dividend.
Well, you know, putting it another way, we could have spent that money on housing the homeless, right? Because there are a large number of people across the country who are being kicked out on the streets again. You know, they might have been given hotel accommodation through COVID, but they're now out on the streets again. That's a disgrace. It could have been spent on dealing with the education system that is not doing our youngsters a service in many places, and it seems to me that we're not investing sufficiently and appropriately in education to create the capabilities we need ahead. It could have actually dealt with some of the social inequality more broadly that we see in the country. I mean, there are things that could have been done, right? And a lot of those potentially would have been activity that would have actually created a strategic future, plus, of course, investing perhaps in some of the businesses that can't get money because the banks won't lend it to them. So there were alternatives, and yet those alternatives were never really tabled at all. And it's because partly ideology, I think, but also partly because people tend to want to think within just their own little frame of reference rather than perhaps stepping back and thinking more broadly. Again, maybe that's ideology and maybe it's not. But the fundamental thing for me is that we don't have a free market, right? We have got a market which is now manipulated by central bankers, by the government, by all of this money that's gone in. And that's going to be an issue because what it basically means is that we're not rewarding risk-taking, we're not necessarily rewarding capital investment appropriately. All right. We're not necessarily rewarding capital investment appropriately. And what that basically means is that the whole thing is just a bit of a game that people play, but the economic foundations that people think works is not the way that things are actually working.
Well, that's one of the things that I think is really, really tough, particularly for young Australians and just non-homeowners in general. Like, you know, I talk to people looking at buying properties and stuff like that, and they ask me, well, you know, how is it fair that people can negatively gear? How is it fair that they get, you know, money from the government to lose money on an investment just so they can hope to make money on rising property prices down the road? And I don't know. I think. It's just what is our country all about? You know, we talk about mateship, we talk about fairness, we talk about all this stuff, but when it comes to, you know, say things like affordable housing, all of a sudden everyone just goes, nah, we'll give that a miss. And I think it's really kind of sad as well, because I talk to some older people who've contacted me and stuff like that after, you know, reading my articles or seeing or something I've said on Twitter. And, you know, some older people have said, well, you know, all I want is my grandkids and my children around to be within a reasonable distance of me so I can be able to enjoy my golden years. And, you know, they don't care that their house is worth $1 squillion. You know, they bought their house, you know, 30, 35 years ago for $10 or whatever it was. And, you know, they'd give it all away tomorrow if it meant that they could stay in that area with their established groups of friends and family and their community and still be able to, you know, be within a reasonable distance of their families. But now, you know, you're seeing people increasingly move to places like Queensland or South Australia or WA or Tasmania in search of an affordable life because, you know, people want to be able to have the space to have a life, the money to have a life. Because, I mean, I know double income couples with no kids who are on, you know, double the median household income, you know, sort of like 180, 190 grand a year. And they sure as hell can't afford a house in most of the places in Sydney. And I mean, if they can't afford it, what hope do the rest of us have? I mean, I sure as hell don't earn $190,000 a year.
Yeah, well, there's some recent research that I saw that suggested that middle Australia can't afford to live in many parts of Australia now, right? You know, the sort of the typical, household, right? So we have completely created the momentum in the wrong direction, and we've completely created the situation where more and more people are essentially going to be struggling to be able to find a way forward. That's a real indictment on our political system, our economic system, and our regulators. I'm afraid that, whether it's hyperinflation or deflation, the actual key questions are beyond that. The key questions relate to, where do we shape our future? How do we shape our future? And who's going to stand up and, lead us there? Because I don't think at the moment we haven't got much of that, and we need some.
The question is are we realistically going to get any? I mean, we've got this sort of just entrenched status quo that's very, very difficult to get rid of. And I think one of the biggest indictments of the current system is that there are lots of little changes around the edges that we could make that could significantly improve things, but we don't. You know, like simple little things. Like I'm not sure how much you may know about like the Centrelink income and assets test. You know, like for example, if you're on the dole and you get a part-time job, your payments get reduced by a rather sizable amount quite quickly. Mm. And that creates that, and that, in fairness to all of the right-wing people who've made this argument, it does create a disincentive to work. And okay, that's right. I will actually agree with that. But what needs to happen is we need to have a better system that incentivizes people to work. That doesn't just go bang, you end up actually earning less money because you're working and paying to commute and, you know, paying to have lunches and paying to have all these other things. But the really, really big one is the pension assets test. That completely distorts the housing market so freaking badly, but it never gets discussed. I mean, the entirety of the pension assets test assumes basically that a house still costs $200,000 to $300,000. So if you're a non-homeowner, you're only allowed to have an extra 250K or whatever it is off the top of my head. So realistically, you 250K, what does that give you in today's environment? You know, you're lucky to get 1% interest. You get $2,500 a year. The other person who has a property gets a house to live in and you know, all the security and benefits that come from that. And so basically you end up with this situation with this perverse disincentive for older people to downsize their houses because they'll immediately lose their pension, even though they won't gain enough money to be able to invest it and put it into something to make up for the fact that they then have to pay rent or they've then lost the pension as an income stream. And I mean, really, how difficult is it to just sit down and do the math, even do it on a city-by-city basis or whatever they have to do to figure out to make it fair, to be able to do that in order so these older people can downsize? Because that is one of the biggest issues facing the property market at the moment. It's the fact that there is little on-market supply. And if these people didn't have the disincentive to downsize, all of a sudden you'd see people, you know, who've just hit pension age all of a sudden saying, oh, maybe I should downsize. Maybe I should buy that townhouse or swap the 5 or 6 bedroom house in the suburbs for something a little bit closer to town for maybe a 3-bedder or something like that, particularly in places like, you know, Brisbane or Perth or Adelaide where things are a little bit more affordable.
Yeah, no, well, I agree about the down trading problem and that we're certainly seeing it. In fact, quite a few down traders that I survey want to down trade, but they can't because the economics don't work for them for the reasons you've just explained, right? So, and there are, you know, there are other things that could be done. And that is really the point, isn't it? Once you start picking this apart, you realize that there are policy levers that could be actually activated, that would actually begin to turn the ship in the direction that we want to see. So it is actually a choice. It is actually a real choice that people could have. If people really want to do this stuff, it could be done. And yet they don't do that. They go the easy route. They basically go the the classic, oh, well, home prices, that's fine. But DeBell says home prices have got to run higher because that's the only way we're going to get unemployment down. So it's a question of choices. And unfortunately, I think we're making the wrong choices at the moment.
I don't know. Like there's this lovely scene in the game Fallout New Vegas where one of the antagonists of the game says to you, well, kid, the game was rigged from the start.
Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid that's probably a good place to end the show today, Tarek. Folks, we're living in a rigged world.
We are, unfortunately.
Step one is to recognize that fact, because step two is then to do something about it, right? But if we don't actually realize that it's rigged to start with, then we never do anything. So thank you, Tarek. You've once again drawn back the curtain and we've revealed a little bit more of how the world really is.
No worries, mate.
Thank you. We'll see you again next time.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Catch you later, mate.
Cheers.